Today we're going to do two conferences on the Decalogue.
Pardon me, Father. We're getting some volume issues at the back of the room.
Can you still hear me okay? Okay, good. We're going to talk about the Decalogue, but we're going to look at it, the Decalogue, which is the Ten Commandments, we're going to look at them from a very specific point of view. We're going to look at them as how they actually teach virtue. It is a common misperception among people that the perfection in the spiritual life consists in stopping sinning. That's actually false. That's actually the beginning of it. The perfection in the spiritual life is sanctified perfection, which is excellence in grace, so you have a lot of sanctifying grace, and the adornment of the soul of all of the virtues. So it's a positive thing. Sanctified perfection is not just someone who stays out of sinning, it's actually someone who exercises in every single act that they perform some type of virtue. And so there is as we go through the Ten Commandments, you're going to be able to see that all of the virtues, all of them are covered in some way or another under the Ten Commandments. In fact, in the old moral manuals before the Second Vatican Council, there were two kinds of moral manuals. There were those who broke the discussion of what was morally right and wrong based upon the Ten Commandments, which weren't that many of them. Most of them did approached it the way St. Thomas and the Scholastics did, which was to look at what is morally right and wrong based upon virtue. Last night I mentioned that the natural law commands all of the virtues, so we have an obligation to develop them, and if you don't perform an act of virtue in a particular instance, and you perform an act of vice, and you violate the natural law. Virtue is obviously that which is in accord with the natural law. It's that which fits our natural inclinations, and so it actually perfects us. The Ten Commandments is a written form of the natural law. In fact, you can actually read the Summa Contra Gentiles of St. Thomas, and he actually shows in there, he argues to all of the conclusions of the Ten Commandments based purely on the natural light of reason. That is, that you can see that, that's not his intent, but he's dealing with various parts of it, and you can see that he's actually showing that the Ten Commandments are just an expression of the natural law. All of the Ten Commandments command justice, every one of them. Every single one of the commandments deal with justice. In the case of the first commandment, it's a matter of the virtue of religion in relationship to God, which we'll talk about. The first three are all in relationship to God, the justice we must render to God, his name, how we're to approach him. The last seven deal with human beings and our justice in relationship to them. So they all deal with justice. And what's justice? Justice is the virtue by which you render someone what's due to them. What's due to God is different than what's due to man. That's why there's 10 commandments and not, and that's actually why there's the precept of charity is not just one commandment, it's two, because you're supposed to love God, and that's different from love your neighbor for the sake of God. So there's two distinct commandments. But they all deal with justice. And they used to say that the first three were called the first tablet and the second three were called the second tablet of the Ten Commandments. But the other commandments, in addition to dealing with justice, they deal with different kinds of virtues. And we want to kind of show, in this first conference, we'll go through the first five commandments to discuss these virtues to see how they actually fit the particular commandment. Of course, the first commandment is, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have strange gods before me. Essentially, what this does is this religion, I am the Lord thy God. Now, that means that there's certain obligations in relationship to him, and it's a twofold thing. We recognize that we have certain obligations to him, but then we also have an obligation to do not to do certain things. Even though most of the commandments, not all of them, even though most of the commandments are negative precepts, the negative precepts, but some of them are actually positive precepts. There's a few of them that are positive precepts. And this is means that it commands not just to avoid sin, but there are certain things you have to do. Right? But even in relation, even if you're going to avoid not falling into sins against even the first commandment, even though it's a negative precept, there's certain things you're simply going to have to do. St. Thomas observes that that the first commandment actually, it does deal with the virtue of religion. And religion is the virtue by which you render to God his due. So there's the virtue of justice. Then underneath that are a number of different sub-virtues. And one of them is the virtue of religion. And he says the virtue of religion has four acts that pertain to it. So there's four things that you must do to fulfill this. So if you don't do these four things to the degree that you're capable, you violate the first commandment. So if you, one of the best things you can do is take a look at the examination of conscience that's in the Manual of Prayers from the Third Council of Baltimore. Because they break it down based upon the various commandments and the sins under it. And you begin to see in there that there are certain things that most people realize that they're failing to do. So these four acts of the virtue of religion are to give alms. And that, of course, is based upon your state in life. Obviously, St. Thomas says, can the poor man develop the virtue of liberality? And he says, no, because he doesn't have any money. But he can have what he calls a preparation of heart or preparation of soul where he desires to do it so that if he had money, he would do it. So there's alms. There's prayer, to which all must do. In fact, neglect of prayer is a sin against the first commandment. And you have an obligation to pray every single day as a matter of justice to God. Most people think, oh, it's no big deal. If I don't pray today, I'll do it tomorrow. Every single day. And there has to be a minimum amount. Then there is there's sacrifice. Now here, as I mentioned in the homily today, that the principle act of sacrifice that God wants from us is the sacrifice of our will, but that sacrifice of our will is actually has merit and is good in relationship to its being joined to the sacrifice of Christ. And then adoration. So those are the four acts of the virtue of religion, which if you fail to do in some manner or another, you actually violate the first commandment. This is also the commandment that commands the virtue of devotion, which is also connected to religion, but devotion to the things of God, not just God, but the things that pertain to God, such as blessed items, sacred items, the relics of saints, these kinds of things, and even the monuments of the church, because they're sacred, the fact that they were gutted, was a sign of a collapse of devotion. It was actually sins against the virtue of devotion, which were sins against the first commandment, when they were gutting churches without a sufficient reason. While the natural law does not dictate the content of the virtue of faith, because the natural law doesn't tell us what we have to believe, it just tells us, though, that we must obey God. And God says we have to have faith. So it points us in that direction. The actual law points us in that direction. But it's actually revealed, what's revelation that tells us what we are actually to believe. But because the natural law tells us we must obey God, then we must actually adhere to the one faith to which he established. We are not permitted to modify it or change it or anything of that sort. So any sin against faith is a sin against the first commandment. And also any sin against hope. Because the hope, because he's our God, that means he will provide for us. And also charity, because he's God, then we are to love him above all things. In fact, we're not supposed to love anything at all, except insofar as we love him. So we're loving him through the thing. That's the goal of perfection and charity. This also means it requires due diligence in the knowledge of the things that pertain to God. Neglecting to come to knowledge about those things that pertain to your faith, pertain to the faith, is a sin against the virtue of religion, and it's a sin against the first commandment. So you have to take the virtue of due diligence. It also requires the virtue of confidence in God's help, hope, as I mentioned before. One of the things that I've discovered more and more is that how directly confidence impacts prayer and its efficacy. The more confident the person is, and here we're not talking audacious and presumptuous, but confident in the sense of knowing that God will give you these things, and not because of the merit of your prayers, but because of his goodness If you have that confidence, he's more likely to give it to you. Demons constantly pick away with people who are possessed or obsessed at their confidence in God. See, he's not helping you. He's not going to help you. He's left you here, to be subject to us, that type of thing. And so so when the person starts praying with more confidence, the demons will really back off. Also, the first commandment commands humility. I am the Lord thy God. You're not God, and you must be subject to him. And you're not at liberty to choose which God you're going to have. He's it. So you have to be humble in knowing your place before him. That's what this virtue is really about. And in that sense, it also commands the virtue of circumspection, although that all the commandments in some way or another, especially the fourth, deal with circumspection. Circumspection is the virtue in which you keep track of your circumstances, and part of that is knowing your place. People just don't seem to know their place anymore. Obviously, you can tell that by some of the new forms of technology and the kinds of research they're doing is, completely offensive to God, trying to usurp his role. And because it commands charity, it requires us to develop charity by making acts of charity at regular intervals. People wonder, well, I'm just not as charitable. I said, well, how often do you tell God you love him? Well, first of all, do you even love him? And what does it mean to love God? It means that you want his glory to be manifest in the created order. And it also means that you want to see him, And if you find you're cold in relationship to that, then you have to start making acts of charity. Why is that? St. Thomas says that with respect to the natural virtues, you can build it just by the acts that you do. He says, but the theological virtues don't have us as their cause. They have God as their cause. God's the one who causes faith in the individual, causes charity, causes hope. And so he says, well, then how can you increase it? He says, yes, you can. What you do is you perform the action in congruity with that virtue so that it disposes you to a greater infusion. And then once God sees that you're disposed to receiving more, he simply just gives you more. So we have to make. So that means you have to tell him regularly during your life, and also times of necessity. It means you can't have anything before him. It means ultimately, the first commandment tells you that your affections can only really rest in God. Ultimately, doesn't mean you can't have affections for your wife, but it should, or your husband, or what have you. But it means it should be done for God's sake. It also requires that you have to put human respect aside to fulfill this commandment, which is against, because if you violate it, it's against charity and justice. How many times do people deny their faith or hide the fact that they're Catholic when they're in the public sector? And so this is because that's part of human respect. It also commands the virtue of wisdom. Why? If he's God, it does two things. Well, let's back up. What is wisdom? Wisdom is the virtue in our intellect by which we are able to understand God from the way God understands himself, from the point of view of the way God sees himself. Today, there's practically no wisdom left in the culture because everybody is looking at God through the lens of their own emotional and appetites. Which is one of the reasons why, this is going to come like a bomb again. The charismatic renewal is dangerous. I'm not saying the people are bad. They're very good people. But it's dangerous because it's ordered towards spiritual gluttony, seeking consolations. If you're going to judge the things of God in relationship to consolation, when you actually do start advancing in your spiritual life, it's going to be brutal. Because St. Paul says God chastises those whom he loves. All the saints say, and John of the Cross talks about how the first thing God does if he wants to purify you is make your life miserable. So you can't judge God based upon your feelings, your interior state, or anything of that sort. And therein kind of lies, Martin Luther violated the first commandment like it was going out of style in a number of different ways. But one of the ways that he did is he transposed, and the Protestants transposed the judgment about what was religiously good or bad from the objective reality, which is revelation and the magisterium who had the right to tell us what that meant, which was an external standard, to the subjective religious experience and the inspiration of the Holy Ghost interiorly in the individual. Once that happened, then it meant in the end that religion is just going to go all over the map and people will start judging God the way they feel about him, and it meant a collapse in the virtue of wisdom. Modernism is the heresy against the virtue of religion, or of, well, that too, but against the virtue of wisdom. Because immanentism, which is its founding principle, its foundational principle, which is judging everything based upon your own subjective experience or yourself and your own thoughts and your own ideas in relationship to God, actually destroys wisdom. Why? Because you're not looking at it from God's point of view. You're looking at it from your own point of view. This is one of the, this is why modernism is so damaging. It also, so it helps to build wisdom, but St. Thomas says that wisdom also is practical in a certain sense. It's primarily about grasping the things of God the way God sees them. And as you grow in charity and as you grow in holiness, things about God start become just, they start becoming clearer. But wisdom also, he says, is practical because it helps us, once you know the end, which is God, then you'll know the things that are going to be bad to do that will block you from getting him and all the things you need to do in order to get to him. So wisdom has a certain practical side. And then there's, of course, there's prudence. Prudence is the virtue in which I know the right thing to do at the right time. St. Thomas defines it more strictly as the virtue in which one knows the means to the end. So he says you have to have a rightly ordered end. You have to know what you're pursuing. And at the same time, you have to, the things that you do have to strive or go towards that. In fact, for St. Thomas, the standard by which whether something is morally right or wrong, I mean, he has a variety of different ways in which he discusses it, but one of them is whether the thing will actually achieve attaining God or not. If it won't, then it's sinful. If it does, then it's not. It's good. And so prudence, the first commandment also requires prudence. On the Lord, thou shalt not have any strange gods before me. It's imprudent to have anything before God. You know, when they say in the Old Testament, all of the gods of the Gentiles are demons, aside from the fact that that's God revealing it through divine inspiration, I can tell you as an exorcist, it is absolutely true. I've seen Osiris, Isis, I've seen Baal, I've seen, you name it. You go back and you look at those Egyptian gods or any of the other gods, and you talk to the various exorcists, and everyone's seen just about all of them. And so the point being is what? Well, it just means that if you're going to be prudent and wise, obviously you can't be involved in the occult. And you can't be involved in things that are superstitious. In fact, superstition is actually a sin against the virtue of religion because it's against the first commandment. And the reason it's superstition is a sin is because St. Thomas says what one does is one attributes to a created thing, the power that's proper to God alone. So what do? To know the future with certitude pertains to God alone. So what do? They look at the tarot cards. The cards can tell me what's going to happen in the future. Ain't going to happen. All right. Now, the demons are really good at guessing, so they can use the tarot cards to kind of tell the person, okay, this is probably what's going to happen, which is actually the case with Nostradamus, whose all his stuff was derived through sorcery. So... The second commandment, thou shalt not take the name of thy Lord thy God in vain. This is the virtue that requires discretion in speech. Okay. And by this we mean it's the virtue that commands modesty in a specific way, that is, in relationship to your speech. This is an important thing because there are two kinds of ways in which you violate this commandment in relationship to this modesty of this modesty in relationship to speech. That is either through blasphemies and profanities, which are against God or things that are holy, and then vulgarities, which are things that demean or denigrate things that are created. In the Old Testament, God says, "Swear neither by heaven, for that is the throne of God, nor by his the earth or created things, because that is his footstool." So these are things like vulgarity, various forms of cursing. People sometimes call it cursing. Cursing can also be, in a more strict sense, of actually trying to condemn somebody. In fact, there's this one time my uncle, he and my dad were driving to go fishing, and there was this cow standing in the road. And my uncle jokingly sticks his head out and curses the cow, and it fell over dead. I think it was actually already dead. It was one of those things where it was stuck, but anyway, okay. So be careful what you do. Okay. So, and this is kind of an important thing, because I think that one of the things, like, for instance, there's kind of this mindset that, you know, it's kind of a manly thing to cuss once in a while. No, it's not. It requires a discipline and self-control. That's the real manly thing. I mean, St. Joseph, who's like the exemplar of what it means to be a man, isn't going to be walking around and, you know, cussing because he smacks his thumb with a hammer. All right. But it also, and, you know, I'm really, you know, today, this means not just vulgarities and profanities directly, but what they call derivatives. Or that's what they, in the, or alternates. In philology, it's called derivatives. Those are things that are derived. Most people don't know. If you look up in an Oxford English Dictionary, the word gosh, it means God. And people use it constantly today, thinking, oh, it's not as bad, right? So we're talking about all of those things that are derivatives, like geez. So you have to be really careful with those. Also, justice to God by rendering our vows to Him is also part of the second commandment. So you have to render any of the vows you've taken. It's a violation. Like, for instance, adultery is not just a violation of the sixth commandment, it's also a violation of the second. Because you've rendered a vow to God and you're now not fulfilling it before Him. So it's a matter of justice to render Him to what you said you would do. When I grew up, if someone said they would do something or they agreed on something in a handshake, that was more binding today than, you know, 500-page contracts are today. Today, contracts practically mean nothing because people are always looking for a way to get out from underneath it. But this is the same way. If you're going to render your vows before God, or you're going to tell God, okay, this is what I'm going to do, then you better do it. Your word has to mean something. Even though today our word might not mean any, people's words may not mean too much in relationship to any kind of promise or thing they make, to God they do. And in fact, keeping a promise is actually, the failure to keep a promise to which you are bound to keep one is also a violation of the second commandment. Which you, don't tell anybody, okay, I promise. And then next thing you know, sorry. All right. So that's modesty in speech. Modesty is the virtue in which we maintain discipline and control in relationship to our externals. So it's not just the dress. It's also the, which we'll talk a little about a little bit later, it's also our speech in relationship to gossiping. It's also speech in relationship to whatever. It's also the way we sit, the way we comport ourselves. It also means that part of the sub-virtue of modesty is decorum, which means our actions fit who and what we are, which is why it makes me a little nervous that, you know, you see these kids who are 22 years of age and they're still acting like they're 16. You know, it's immodest, aside from the fact that it's immature. The third commandment, remember that thou art to keep holy the Lord's Sabbath. This commands the virtue of religion in relationship to prayer and sacrifice. In the end, you don't get to heaven unless you sacrifice your will to God. That is it. It's the ultimate thing. I mean, you have to be in the state of grace. God will put you in the state of grace because he'll make you pleasing to Him once you do that. But that's actually, that sacrifice is required. And also prayer. It requires modesty through what's called eutrapelia. That's eutrapelia, for those who want to know how it's spelled. Eutrapelia is the virtue of right recreation. Working constantly is not a virtue. The inability to relax is a vice. Why? Because eutrapelia is ordered towards, St. Thomas says, the pleasures of recreation, you know, enjoying yourself in some type of a game or relaxation or conversation, that's done in order to recreate the soul so that it can go back to working and serve God. I can't remember which saint it was. They were playing chess. And one of them asked, what would you do if Christ returned? And he said, I'd keep playing chess. And he said, why? He said, because this is what he would be expecting me to do when he showed up. Because that was what their rule required. So a person has to develop the virtue of right recreation. In other words, this is the day you're supposed to take time off, period. And that also means that it's the virtue that requires detachment and restraint in relationship to money and to goods. This is why the church has always said it's sinful to engage in unnecessary commerce or work on a Sunday. I know that's completely collapsed, but I'm sorry, God is not pleased with it. So we have an obligation to take time off and not to be working on that. But it also requires that you're supposed to take that keep holy the Sabbath means. It's not that you just sit and watch football games for 9 hours on the Sunday. I'm not saying watching football, well, if you can manage to get through the scantily clad women on the commercials. But if the point is that it's actually meant you should be doing something else. You should be doing some type of spiritual reading or extra prayer on that day. Or taking the time just to think about the things of God. Do some reading, you know, about your faith or something like that. It's not just to sit in front of the TV. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't watch a football game. But it just means that, or baseball or things like that. It just simply means that that stuff has to be moderated. Because if it goes to excess, it's contrary to the virtue of eutropelia. Because eutropelia is the virtue of right recreation. It means it moderates, St. Thomas says, the pleasures in relationship to recreation, to play, he says. And so if you don't moderate that, then you don't moderate the pleasure, and that lack of moderation of the pleasure means you're attached to the pleasure, and in the scholastic term, that's called effeminacy. Effeminacy is the virtue or the vice in which a person is unwilling to put aside their pleasure to pursue what's arduous. Then there is, it requires that detachment from created things, and mortification. It requires the virtue of mortification. You know, if you can wait until tomorrow, you wait until tomorrow. It also requires a certain amount of discipline. You have to plan for Sunday, you know. Don't go to the refrigerator with nothing in it on a Sunday. Just, you know, plot out what you need to do. Make sure you don't have to do the least amount of work on a Sunday. It also means no servile work. What is servile? It's what a servant would do. It's anything that's physically laborious. Sorry, you can't hoe your garden on a Sunday. People say, well, I enjoy it and it makes me feel better. I don't care. The issue is that it's servile. That's what the church said. No unnecessary servile work on a Sunday. It's supposed to be a day of relaxation. And it requires the virtue of obedience. The natural law tells us that we must worship God. But the natural law does not tell us how we are to worship God. Revelation is what tells us how we are to do that, and we must obey those who God puts in charge of his church. Therefore, we must attend Mass to fulfill not just the precept of the church of attending Mass on Sundays and holy days of obligation, but also in order to fulfill the natural law in relationship to the virtue of obedience, the virtue of religion, the virtue of faith, etc. But it also tells us something that is quite important. I don't know if I've mentioned this here, but one of the reasons why it's so important for the magisterium to tell the priest how to offer Mass is because when he approaches the altar, he has to submit to God if he's going to be pleasing to God. And if the thing is completely at his discretion, he's constantly changing, and it becomes his own. And what this really means is that all the options tend to chisel away at obedience, at least psychologically, not in themselves, but psychologically. But it basically boils down to this. Why is the magisterium to do it? Because they're the ones who are given the grace because of their state of life or their office. God will give them the grace to tell us how they're supposed to, how it's supposed to be done. But I'll finish off what that means concretely here in a minute. Because human beings are essentially stupid. And especially when it comes to God, we're dumb as a bag of hammers. Because how do you know this? All you have to do is get on YouTube and watch the liturgical dancing being done in Los Angeles, and you'll see how stupid human beings can be. You're just like, what is that? Mm-hmm. One time this friend of mine was at this mass, and all of a sudden this nun in her mid-50s, rather rotund, started dancing around the sanctuary for liturgical dance in white leotards. It's where people are at. That's why in the Old Testament, what happened? In the Old Testament, God doesn't leave how we're supposed to worship to us because we're too stupid. We don't know Him well enough to know what suits Him. So He has to come down and tell us. That's why in the Old Testament, He was explicit. This is to be done in this manner, in this way, on these dates, by these people. And that's why He did it. Then, what did He do? What did Christ do? He said, do this in commemoration of Me. Not what you want, hanging around belting out kumbayas. You are to do this in commemoration of Me. So He has to be the one. I tell people, look, if you don't know somebody and they come over to your house and you think, I think this guy would like cow brains and tripe for dinner because you happen to like it, sorry, it ain't going to work. And that's the way we are in relationship to God. He has to be the one to show us this is the type of worship that's suited to Me and pleases Me. Now, what does this mean about the Mass? Christ said, do this in commemoration of Me. All of the rites of the Mass, except one, all of the rites of the Mass in the Church are traceable back to one of the Apostles. The Roman Rite is traceable very close to St. Peter, but there's enough in the tradition that we're pretty sure that St. Peter was the one who wrote parts of the first Eucharistic prayer in the New Rite, but what's called the Canon of the Mass. Then what do they do? God slowly, through saints who knew His mind and had the virtue of wisdom, He slowly fashioned the liturgy until we reached 1969, where the first liturgy in the entire history of the Church was created that had no organic connection to one of them beforehand. So what's that mean? If Christ said, do this, well, we should have been following that. And if you want to read my upcoming book... If I can find a publisher, my first publisher is like, oh, I love this, and then he summarily just booted me. I talk about why the tradition binds in conscience. It's not a preference. It's not because it makes you feel good. There are obligations in relationship, and it's called the virtue of piety, which we're going to get to here in the next virtue. The fourth commandment, honor thy father and thy mother. This is the virtue, this commands honor. That means the virtue of piety is the virtue by which we give honor primarily to our parents. But it also is extended to all those things that are above us. This is the virtue which has a sub-virtue, the virtue of patriotism. You are to love your country. Doesn't mean you have to like what the government is up to and what they're doing. In fact, if you love your country, you'll want to boot the criminals out and get the right people in. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting a little bit nervous because some of the trads are just like hammering our country. I'm like, there's no piety in that. Be careful. Piety desires to see the good for our country as part of the virtue of patriotism. But the virtue of piety is not just it's not just to our parents, but it means that we have an obligation to honor them. What is honor? St. Thomas says that honor is praise or deference paid in relationship to some excellence that the person possesses. What's this excellence that that our parents have in relationship to us? They gave us life. It doesn't matter if your parent is bad. You still have to honor them, not because they're bad or what have you, but because that excellence, which is some type of manifestation of God's nature in some way. It applies to family, it applies to work, applies to marriage, it applies to our superiors. I think one of the most appalling thing that I am seeing today is the way people treat priests.
Yes.
I was talking to a woman about 4 or 5 months ago, and she said she contacted me. She says, I've just noticed that all these people keep attacking the priests. I said, yeah. I said, I only know of two priests that I'm aware of out of the hundreds and hundreds of priests that I know of, only two that have not been viciously attacked by the lay people in some way or another. And this woman says, well, what do you think it means? I said, I'll tell you exactly what it means. It means in the very near future, you will not have regular access to a priest. That's what that means. God always takes away from people something when they abuse it. He did it to the Jews in the Old Testament. He does it to us too. The first three, so what's this mean? It means even if he's a bad priest, and when I was growing up, even if he was a flaming liberal, you still treated him with deference because he was a priest. I mean, it didn't mean you agreed with him or that you liked him or you did necessarily what he told you to do, but it was, you still treated him with that deference. The first three, of course, of the commandments are to establish our relationship to God who is above. This establishes our relationship to those who are above us, but this commandment establishes those who are above us in this life. Our parents, all those people. It commands obedience to those, the virtue of obedience, to those above us in accord to their authority. You know, so if your boss tells you, look, you got to do this, you should do it. I mean, as long as it's not sinful and it's not going to, you know, hurt anybody, you do it. It also means that but also it's honor. One of the things that's collapsed is part of the virtue of piety is to have filial devotion for those who are above us. There should be a filial devotion to the priesthood, filial devotion to the office of a bishop. How many traditionalists really respect the bishops? I mean, okay, I agree with Bishop Broskowitz. It's a hapless bench of bishops. That's true. But that doesn't mean that you stand up there and just verbally hammer them in public, right? Which is what you're seeing people doing today. There should be a filial devotion. It's filial devotion to the office of the papacy, the office of the bishop. We should love these things and desire their good. And we should desire for the people that are in it instead of them just being, you know, cast into hell. We should desire that they are actually become better. We should be praying for them. It commands obedience, so to those who are above us. As to those who are below us, the virtue of piety and also the fourth commandment requires a proper treatment of those under our care. This means wives, children, employees, etc. This is one of the reasons why you actually know that the Muslim religion is just not from God. It's not part of the natural law because, you know, they're supposed to beat their wives and things like that. By the way, you know where that came from in the Muslims. You know who convinced Muhammad to put it in the Quran? It was his wife. Figure that one out. There must have been something wrong with her. All right. So it means that we should do proper treatment of those under our care. That means our wives, our children, our employees, whatever. We have an obligation to treat them with respect. It requires diligence in our duties to those around us. This means our household duties, the duties of a husband to his wife, to children, to work, things of this sort. So actual neglect of these things is a sin against the fourth commandment. So, doesn't mean you can't put a little bit of the housework off if you're really tired, but, you know, sitting around eating bonbons, watching soap operas day in and day out, and your husband comes home, isn't going to work. By the way, did you see the new study that just came out in, I think it was Norway? They found out in studies that marriages in which the traditional roles are followed, where the wife stays home and the husband goes to work, and the wife stays home and takes care of the domestic affairs and the children, have a much lower rate, almost a 50% lower rate of divorce.
Wow.
So, those are little tidbits you keep track of. It requires justice at work, to not neglect our work. That also falls under thou shalt not steal. You're not supposed to waste your employer's property by dishonesty or carelessness or neglect or violating company principles without a sufficient reason. You know, you should want order within your company and you should want to do it yourself. It commands distributive justice. Now, there's three kinds of justice. There's distributive justice. That's from those who are in charge of the common good to those who are below. So it's from the universal to the particular. Then there's commutative justice. That's between the two two people at the lower level. And then there's legal justice, which is between those who are on the lower level to the common good, and those in charge of the common good. But in this particular, the fourth commandment commands distributive justice in relationship to those who are professionals and civil servants. Culpable lack of knowledge relating to the duties of office or profession, or neglect in discharging those duties, or misuse of authority, or any kind of injustice or partiality is against the virtue of piety. And also Christ is brutal in extracting justice in relationship to that for those who are in authority. Also, it makes the person recognize that authority is never for the individual who has it. It's always ordered towards the good of those who are under it. It requires patriotism, as I said, as a sub-virtue of piety, and therefore we have an obligation to respect the laws of the land as long as they are not sinful. Even if they're stupid. Now, it's not because, you know, because somebody said, you mean to tell me if I'm driving down a highway and all of a sudden there's a stop sign in the middle of the road, I'm supposed to stop? I said, yes. Not because somehow or another, you know, stopping in the middle of nowhere is a good thing, but because developing the virtue of piety is a good thing. Okay, I'm going to submit to this for that virtue's sake. Okay. The fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill. This requires justice to the neighbor, the innocent, the unborn, those who are dying. St. Thomas says that to take someone's life directly is the proper is the effect of something that is a capital crime, that is, it's penal. To take someone's life is penal. It's a punishment for having done something wrong. Euthanasia, he says, so if you're going to take someone's life, there has to be something they're doing that's wrong. Euthanasia, you know, taking people's lives before, under the guise of mercy, is punishing somebody for something with which they're not guilty of. People say, oh, I'm, you know, it's uncompassion to let them suffer. No, it's not. God may want them to suffer for their benefit if they're still around, because God thinks it's good for them. You know, it may not feel good, but it's still there. Okay. This also requires justice in relationship to self. It requires justice to love oneself on a natural level, but according to the natural law. What does that mean? Well, part of the natural law realizes you're not the only cat in town, and so you don't do everything for your own sake. In fact, the natural law says you have to do things because it's ordered towards the common good and other things and towards virtue. But even though it requires justice, in the end, because of fallen human nature, we're really only going to fulfill even the requirements of justice through charity, grace. Grace is the only way we're going to be able to love ourselves in a rightly ordered, unselfish fashion. Because what is selfish? That you want the thing for yourself. What's charity? You love yourself for God's sake. It commands meekness. Thou shalt not kill. So what's meekness? Meekness is the virtue by which you don't go to extreme in your reactions. Clemency is the virtue in which you have mercy towards somebody who's committed something evil because it's good for them. But this virtue, it also commands clemency, but it commands meekness because it's sins against anger. Christ said, you know, he who has anger for someone, you know, has already killed him, right? Well, that has to do with the fact of what commandment it's being placed under. So no anger, no quarreling. It also requires the virtue of fortitude, which moderates anger. Because virtue is the fortitude is where a person engages things that are hard and difficult, but you don't overdo it and you don't underdo it. And it avoids neglect of not falling into battle. A lot of people just don't fight for what's right anymore today. Of course, I'm sure you've heard that phrase, bad things happen when good men do nothing. And that's exactly, we are now reaping the rewards of generations of people not doing what they were supposed to do. It commands temperance, that is abstinence and fasting. Why? Well, because if you eat to the point where you're going to, you know, blow it up like a balloon, you're going to kill yourself. So And this is an important thing because it helps us to realize that food is not there for the pleasure of it. God gives us a pleasure of it so that it makes the action easier to engage in. Rather, the food is there for your health's sake. So eating must be done for the health, not for pleasure alone. So again, this also means we have to take reasonable care of our health. It also means no piercing, no tattooing, no body modifications. It means all those things. No contraception, because contraception, certain kinds of contraception are just forms of mutilation. It's like sterilization. This is the virtue that wonders to God to fulfill the obligations of God in relationship to reproduction. Shalt not kill. Okay. But it also means that you have to be open to life. It commands sobriety, you know, no excessive drinking. Justice to God to preserve oneself as one is. Right? So people who want transgender operations are violating the fifth commandment, among a variety of other things. All right. It commands the virtue of charity, specifically joy, at least in relationship to others' prosperity rather than envy or jealousy. In other words, we should be happy that other people have good things. It commands the virtue of clemency, that you're not too extreme in your punishments, as I mentioned. It commands the virtue of forgiveness. Thou shalt not kill. Well, how are you going to not kill somebody? Well, if they've done something that's pretty bad, sometimes you have to forgive them so that you don't end up seeking to put an end to their life, which is the effect of the anger. It requires the virtue of piety. Oh, let me back up in relationship to forgiveness. St. Thomas asked the question, do you have to forgive somebody always? And he says, yes, interiorly. You must always interiorly let loose of the debt that somebody owes you and forgive them. But he says, you don't always show the effects of that forgiveness. For example, suppose some daughter goes off and reduces the family name by living with some guy, and you know, it's an injustice against the parents, which incidentally we're going to talk about that a little bit in the next commandment, but they're committing an injustice against the parents, and the parents have to forgive her. That doesn't mean they treat her as if nothing's wrong. It just means that they still have to be charitable and civil, but they don't necessarily say, oh, everything's hunky fine. Yeah, you can bring your, you know, live-in boyfriend over for dinner tomorrow. No, it's not how it works. Which incidentally brings up a particular aspect. It's one of those things where you almost have to, you know, keep yourself from crawling over the table and strangling the individual for even saying it types of reactions I get, is when the person, the daughter or the son, decide to get married outside the church, and then they turn around and ask the parents, are you coming? And then the parents say, well, no, we can't because you're getting married outside the church. And they say, you're being mean and uncharitable. Excuse me. You're the one who are putting your parents in a situation where they have to make a hard decision. You're the one that's uncharitable. Don't give me that nonsense. All right. It also commands the virtue of prior relation to God as to other non-rational creatures, but not by not causing them unnecessary death or suffering. Not because they have rights. Animals don't have rights. A right is a moral claim on the obligations of another. An animal doesn't have an intellect or a soul or an intellect to make that moral claim, so it doesn't have any rights. But that doesn't mean you have to treat it like trash. It's still a creation of God. So if you can denigrate the Creator by treating it badly. So what's this mean about environmentalism? You are required, this has always been a teaching of the church, you are required to take proper care of the environment, not for its sake, but for the sake of the human beings who have to live in it now and in the future. I have a theory, by the way. And I'm waiting to see if it's going to play itself out in this generation. This is my theory. If you look when Adam and Eve fell, they went from, you know, it talks about how the paradise was just so full of all these good and pleasurable things, and nature was so delightful and provided so much for us, right? Well, then they fell, and then what was the punishment? It says, now you have to work in thorn, you know, among thorns, and it's going to be hard, it's sweat of your brow, etc. Which meant that nature provided a little bit less for us. Then, right before the, there is a theory that states that there was an actual firmament. I mean, the scriptures being literal, that there was actually water contained in a firmament above. And they have some pretty good scientific basis for saying it. And that when the flood happened, because men were being evil, that firmament created higher pressure in the atmosphere, which is why plants, they know this for a fact, plants grow bigger and faster in higher pressure of air. So which is why the plants in the past were much larger. And then when that collapsed, when man was being really sinful, that all collapsed, and so nature then provided a little bit even less. So now it's not as if the plants aren't as big, they don't produce as much fruit. And I think we're getting to a stage now where the sin is so bad and man's abuse of nature is so bad, we're about to head into something that's going to make it even worse for the upcoming generations. Okay, so what does this mean? You know, it's not, you don't hug the tree because you want to make it feel good. Right. But you don't go around mowing things down and, you know, destroying the environment because it impacts people's ability to live right, ordered lives in relationship to their own financial and their own, you know, you don't pollute the air, you know, you don't just start spewing toxins out just to get rid of them so you don't have to pay a lot of money because it affects other people. That's where the rights really lie. It's not in the environment. It's in the people who have to live in the environment. Okay. We'll stop there and come back. When's the next conference?
11.
At 11. We'll come back at 11 for the last of the five commandments. Okay.